Okay. Okay. Erev Tov, good evening, everyone. My name is Donnie Schreiber, for those of you who don't know. I work in the shul, I assist Rabbi Beller, which might or might not make me the assistant rabbi, depending on who you ask. And I give shiurim and in general, I have this list to teach Torah in this wonderful shul. And tonight, we're going to continue in the series that that the shul is providing on religious Zionism. Tonight is going to be a little bit different than other nights. For a few reasons. Number one, I saw the Makor sheet from last week. Sorry, I don't do that. I saw it was one sheet, no? Yeah. I currently manage with one sheet. I don't know how to do that. So, at least this time, everything's in English. So we're not going to be reading everything inside. I'll give you a brief overview, but it's for your own usage, for homework or whatever have you. When you get home, you can read it inside. You can even buy the books. I can tell you where everything's from. But it's different because I think that what we'll find is that Rabbi Soloveitchik's position vis-a-vis, well, I guess what we would call religious Zionism, is somewhat complicated and challenging. Before we even get to the Rav, Rabbi Soloveitchik, Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik, was known by his contemporaries, by his students, popularly as the Rav, which is not so unique. Apparently the Rav Kook was also the Rav, and so was the Lubavitcher Rebbe, but the Rav has a book about him called the Rav, so I guess he wins. This is a book by Rav Aaron Rekefet Rothkopf, who's spoken here. Rabbi Rekefet wrote two volumes, basically, of quotations from Rabbi Soloveitchik. It's not a biography per se, but things that he said. And before we get to the Rav himself, though, I want to kind of just take a poll and kind of see where we stand. We're several weeks into this course, and you've heard a lot about religious Zionism, about Zionism, about religious Zionism. What would you say are some of the key code words, concepts, ideas that are core to any true religious Zionist? Just throw terms out there. I wanna hear where we stand.
Before I'd say we living proceed. In Israel.
Mm-hmm. Living, the importance of living in Israel, almost the central importance, as though it, you know, Yishuv Haaretz, building up the land, and perceive maybe the mitzvah of Yishuv Haaretz, but even more than maybe.
Many mitzvahs which cannot be done here in Eretz Yisrael.
There are mitzvot that cannot be done elsewhere, that can only be done in Eretz Yisrael. This is religious Zionism. Okay, anything else? Kibbutz Galuyot, in gathering of the exiles. Okay, great, perfect. What do you mean by Kibbutz Galuyot? Exactly. I mean, I know what you mean physically.
Exile ending.
The exile, oh, exactly what I wanted to hear. The idea of the ingathering of the exiles, meaning the exile is over. Yeah. That we are now in a process of ge'ula, of redemption, of the final redemption, of the end of days, of Yimot HaMashiach. Would you say that this is a core concept of any card-carrying religious Zionist? Okay, anything else? Yeah.
You don't have to be religious to be a Zionist.
Okay, very good.
That's very important to me.
The idea that Zionism is related somehow to Judaism, even
to the land,
to a nationalistic nationalism. Is that fair? Nationalism, that this is our national homeland.
Homeland.
And how do we know that? In other words, what's our claim to that?
It could be
a historical claim. Okay. In other words, outside of the Torah, the Jews have some kind of relationship with Israel.
Or it could be something that was granted to the Jews through various modern institutions such as the United Nations.
Okay.
And it does belong to the Jews.
Okay.
And you don't have to be a religious Jew, but they belong to you.
Okay. Okay. But that's fine. That's within Zionism. Okay. It fits. We'll see if it fits into religious Zionism. Anything else? Okay. So what I think we're going to find is that whereas almost everybody, I assume, that you've heard of until now assumed all or most of the concepts that we just mentioned, Rabbi Soloveitchik is not going to, you know, be exactly in that line. And it may be challenging to some of you, but that's the way it is. And nothing that Rav did or said was not challenging. And so let's begin. Okay. The first thing that we're going to do is get a little bit of the history. In other words, he lived a long life. Rabbi Soloveitchik lived from 1903 until 1993. He lived 90 years. The last few years of his life, he was not so active. But until then, he was very, very, very active. And we'll start even before. Even before he was alive. Where did he come from? Where did Rabbi Soloveitchik come from? So the truth is, the Soloveitchiks themselves, it's an old name. It's a regal name. The Soloveitchiks, Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, even before. Rav Soloveitchik, the one that I'm talking about right now, his namesake, his great-grandfather, also Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik, Rav Yasha Ber Soloveitchik, was what we call the Beis HaLevi. He was the rabbi of Brisk. He was involved with the Volozhin Yeshiva, and he was a force. But it's really his son, Rabbi Chaim Soloveitchik, who's one of the most famous rabbinic Jews of the last 200, 300 years. Rabbi Chaim Soloveitchik is known for his innovations and the power of his mind in terms of Talmudic thinking. Almost all learning that goes on in standard Ashkenazi Lithuanian style yeshivos right now inherits from the approach that Rav Chaim Soloveitchik basically brought into being.
That's the Soloveitchik's father?
No, that's his grandfather. It's his grandfather.
Can we have the years of the lifespan?
I'm not really good at that. But it's about 200 years. He was towards the Beis HaLevi was during the years of Volozhin. His great-grandfather was the Beis HaLevi. Rav Chaim Soloveitchik was towards the end of the yeshiva of Volozhin. Which I would, I'm not very good at this. Late 1800s, the end of the 19th century, and so Rav Chaim Soloveitchik. So Rav Chaim Soloveitchik was a force in terms of his Talmudic thinking. He was also a Rav. He was also the rabbi of Brisk, of the town of Brisk, and in fact, at the time, was probably more well known for his chesed and for his compassion in the town of Brisk. Anybody know? For those of you who have heard of Chaim Soloveitchik, does anybody know what it says on his tombstone? Talking about they called him the chemist. That's what they called him. Because of the way that he saw the Talmud, the way that he invented new ways of looking at the Talmud, they called him the chemist. Wasn't a nice name that they gave him. That was the bad nickname that they gave him for people who didn't like his innovations. But what did it say on his tombstone, despite the fact that, as I said, he was basically the grandfather of all modern Talmudic thinking? Rav Chesed. During his lifetime, he was known much more for his chesed than for his Talmudic thinking. There are many, many, many stories about his chesed. What was his take on Zionism? Now, obviously, we can't ask what was his take on Hakamat HaMedina, because it didn't happen in his lifetime. But, of course, the Zionist movement began way before Hakamat HaMedina, as I'm sure you all know and have all been learning. So Rabbi Soloveitchik tells the story himself. He talks about his grandfather. He didn't meet his grandfather. And he knew many, many stories about his grandfather because he was so famous. And he says here, when Rav Chaim Soloveitchik was one of the Rosh Yeshiva and the Volozhin Yeshiva, he heard that there was a group of students, a secret group of students, that were Zionists and that tried to further the Zionist movement. The question was, what was Rabbi Chaim Soloveitchik, what was his stance towards this movement? Was he positive? It's basically like there was a Zionist club in Yeshiva. That's basically what it was. And he said, and Rabbi Soloveitchik says that actually Rav Chaim wanted to know who they were, and he went so far as to try to interrogate one of the students in the yeshiva who he thought knew, to try to get him to give up the names of the people in this club so that he could expel them from the yeshiva. He was so against the political Zionist movement that he would not stand for these students to be in his yeshiva. And the truth was that position was not a rare position. Many, many, many of the Lithuanian rabbis and the European rabbis were against this, as I'm sure you've learned, were against the Zionist movement, but particularly Rabbi Soloveitchik's grandfather, who he inherited a lot of his intellectual tradition from. So it should tell you a little bit about where Rabbi Soloveitchik should stand. He was a Soloveitchik. But it doesn't stop there. Here, and I'm kind of going to give away a little bit of the plot, this is a statement that Rabbi Soloveitchik made in one of his Chamesh Drashot. Rabbi Soloveitchik was, at a certain point, the honorary president of the Mizrahi movement in America, the RZA, the Religious Zionists of America, which is the American arm of the Mizrahi movement. And he gave a series of Drashot every single year at their annual convention. And here's what he said about his uncle. Rabbi Chaim Soloveitchik, who was his grandfather, had a few sons. One was Rav Moshe Soloveitchik, who was the Rav's father. And the other was Rav Yitzchak Zev Soloveitchik, who became the Brisker Rav. When we say the Brisker Rav, that's what we refer to. Rav Yitzchak Zev Soloveitchik, who was also very famous. He was considered the primary son of Rav Chaim. So he was also a force unto himself. He eventually, at the end of his life, he moved to Eretz Yisrael and lived in Eretz Yisrael, but was by no means a Zionist. In fact, Rabbi Soloveitchik says himself, "I had many doubts about the validity of the Mizrahi approach. After all, my roots are very deeply intertwined with the oral tradition of rabbinic scholarship. His entire outlook was not political. It was in Shas and Poskim. It was in Torah. That was his outlook. And he inherited that outlook from his father and from his grandfather and from his uncle. And he says, nevertheless, this is actually still Rav Chaim. The next part will be about the Brisker Rav. He says, nevertheless, the land of Israel occupied a major role in my house." This is talking about Rav Chaim Soloveitchik. Sorry to confuse you. Let's go back. He's talking about Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, his grandfather, the one who said that he would root out the students who were involved in the Zionist movement. What did he say? He said, "Rav Chaim was the first to halachically analyze, define, and conceptualize on an extraordinary intellectual level the topics pertaining to the land of Israel, namely, what we mentioned before, the mitzvot that apply only in Eretz Israel. Rav Chaim was the first one to really rigorously analyze and describe and innovate those halachot. He was the first one because most people didn't involve themselves in it because it wasn't practical. It wasn't practical, it wasn't nogeya at the moment. But Rav Chaim was very into the theoretical parts of the law. And even more than that, not even so theoretical. He says, in the last paragraph, these terms represented not only concepts, abstract thoughts, and formal insights, but they also reflected deep-rooted emotions of love, yearnings, and vision for the land of Israel. Okay? Discussions of the sanctity of the land of Israel, the holiness of walled cities, the sanctity of Jerusalem, were my lullabies, my bedtime stories. He constantly delighted in the thought that after he married off his children, he would transfer his rabbinate to one of his sons and then settle in the land of Israel. There he would purchase an orchard and fulfill the agricultural laws which pertain to the land of Israel. In other words, the very same Rav Chaim, who was against the political Zionist movement to the degree that he would want to root out of his yeshiva all students who were involved in the Zionist movement, that very same Rav Chaim Soloveitchik dreamed of one day making aliyah, getting a farm, and tilling the land. Okay, it's the same one. We have the same thing that he says about his uncle. This is in another essay, in a sefer we have over here, Divrei Hagut V'Harakha. This is in the Hesped. This is in the eulogy that he gave for Rav Yitzchak Zev, Rav Velvo, his uncle. They said of him that he was opposed to the state of Israel. So Rav Soloveitchik says, this is not correct. Opposition to a state emanates from adopting a position regarding a political body. In other words, he says, by saying that Rav Yitzchak Zev Soloveitchik, that the Brisker Rav was against the state of Israel, you were saying that he had a position vis-a-vis the state of Israel. And he said, Rav Soloveitchik says, he didn't have a position. It didn't fit into his worldview. He was anti in the sense that he thought that it was garnished. He didn't think it was worth talking about. Because all he was interested in was the halakha. If you started to talk to him about political movements and political machinations, he wasn't interested. He would kick you out because he didn't want to talk about it. Says he was unable to translate the idea of a sovereign secular state to halachic properties and values. He believed that the idea of the Medina, of Eretz Israel, did not fit into the halachic categories of the way that we should relate to Eretz Israel. So for instance, let's say, for example, the Prime Minister of Israel. What would be the potential halachic analog for the Prime Minister of Israel? The king. Right? So Ravelvo rejected that and thereby said the Prime Minister is garnished because he doesn't mean anything. Or the army of Eretz Yisrael, of Medinas Yisrael rather, would supposed to be corresponding to the army of Klal Yisrael in Eretz Yisrael. Garnished, he says, that doesn't work. So because it doesn't work, in that sense he was anti-Zionist. In that sense. But to say that he was against Israel, Rabbi Soloveitchik would say, of course not. He wasn't against Israel. He wasn't even against making aliyah. Right? You see that his grandfather, Rav Chaim, wanted to make aliyah. That was his dream. He wasn't against people making aliyah. He was just against the idea of the political entity, primarily because of its secular nature. That was what they were against. So
he would have been very happy to make aliyah and live here, for example, under the Ottomans?
Yeah.
Yeah, because for him it's just the
brisket route made Aliyah, as far as I know, before Hakamat HaMedina. They were very happy.
So rather that the Holy Land rather than Medinat Israel under any kind.
Would he rather? I don't know. I think he probably would rather. I think he probably would rather. There's no way to know, whenever you talk about these figures, there's no way to know with any certainty how they would relate to Medinat Yisrael as we have it now. In other words, they had a certain vision of what Eretz Yisrael, of what Medinat Yisrael would be, and they were against that. I have no idea if what we have now corresponds to what they imagined we would have. It may well be. It may well be that it's exactly what they were afraid of. It may well be. But I have no idea.
Excuse me, Rabbi. I might be asking something stupid, but I don't understand, if you're anti-Zionism, how you can be for Israel. I actually find that hard to understand.
The word Zionist in this context refers to the political movement of Zionism, which is to say the Jews should take control of the land, have a government, run the government, for lack of a better word, tick everybody else off in the region, you know, annoy everybody else in the world, and at the cost of annoying everybody else in the world, and as though this is also, by the way, a part of the eventual redemption. That's what Zionism means for them, and they were against that. Why? I'm going to actually save the answer to that question for them. I'm going to save that for other lectures, because in a couple of weeks you'll have those lectures. I think you're going to have Ultra Orthodoxy on religious Zionism. I want to focus on Rabbi Soloveitchik. I only tell you these things to give you an idea of the intellectual inheritance that Rabbi Soloveitchik entered. In other words, this was his life, this was his grandfather, this was his father, and he wasn't interested in rebelling against them, because he revered them. Everybody revered them. It wasn't a matter of him growing up in this household and just saying, you know, this is stupid, I want to go off on my own. And he says that himself. If you look at the last source on the first sheet, now we're going to get into the Rav's life, after taking a look at his uncle and his grandfather, which were potentially, aside from his father, the two most important influences on his life. I was not born into a Zionist household. This is from a speech that he gave to the Mizrahi. My parents' ancestors, my father's house, my teachers and colleagues were far from the Mizrahi religious Zionists. They too held my medal in the secrets of the Merciful One. The entire Zionist enterprise is to say, we are going to take control of our destiny. We are going to force God's hand by creating a land. The Lithuanian, the European approach that was anti-Zionist said, no, we need to sit back and wait for it. Quietist, that's what the word for that is. They were pacifists. They weren't interested in forcing the hand of redemption. Perhaps because they didn't believe you should. Perhaps because they had been burned in the past by false hopes, by false messiahs maybe, which definitely a specter lay over that idea. And Zionism definitely suffered from Shabtai Tzvi's failed attempt of messianism. Definitely suffered. Was definitely suspected because of that. And so he says, they too held of that. My links with the Mizrahi grew gradually. I had my doubts about the validity. In other words, he says, I was not into this at the beginning of my life. Says, if I now identify with Mizrahi against my family tradition, it is only because, as previously clarified, I feel that divine providence ruled like Joseph and against his brothers. This is a famous passage. Here, Rabbi Soloveitchik, in this drasha, basically compares himself to the rest of his family and sees himself as Joseph and the rest of his family as the brothers. Joseph, who has a dream, and believes a certain thing about the way that the world is going to work and his place within that world, and the brothers who reject that. And of course, he says, we know how the story ends. The brothers end up being dragged down to Mitzrayim and bow down to him, just as his dream foretold. He employs secular Jews as instruments to bring to fruition his great plans regarding the land of Israel. Of course, one of the main problems with the anti-Zionists, with Zionism in general, religious Zionism might not have been an idea at the time, was that most of the Zionists were secular. They weren't religious. And so the idea that we were now going to enter the land and take it over was basically saying the secular Jews are going to go into the land and take it over, and that was unthinkable. And he says, Rabbi Soloveitchik says, I'm going to break with that. I don't think it's unthinkable. I also believe that there would be no place for Torah in Israel today were it not for the Mizrahi. This is where he, you know, compliments the Mizrahi, saying that they had a role in there being any Torah at all. And here he speaks about his own sacrifice, his own pain, when he came to this decision. He's telling the listeners, it did not come lightly to him. I built an altar upon which I sacrificed sleepless nights, doubts, and reservations. Regardless, the years of the Hitlerian Holocaust, the establishment of the State of Israel, and the accomplishments of the Mizrahi in the Land of Israel convinced me the correctness of our movement's path. What convinced Rabbi Soloveitchik to be a, quote-unquote, for now, a religious Zionist? Two things.
The Holocaust.
Two things, two facts on the ground. Number one,
the Holocaust.
Number one, the Holocaust. We can't sit back anymore. We need to do something. Number two,
establishment of the state.
What's going on in the state? The state actually is working out. It's not what we were afraid of. The flowering of Torah because of Mizrahi. What we were afraid of isn't happening. We're going to see afterwards that it was not just the Holocaust of the Jews being killed, and it wasn't just what happened after the founding of the state, but it was the founding of the state itself. We're going to see very soon. It was also a big influence. But what do we see? We see a transformation. Rabbi Soloveitchik actually acknowledges the idea that he changes his mind. There's another figure, the author of the Ema Benim Smicha, also, Rav Teichtal, was famous for changing his mind. He grew up in a Hasidic background, and the Hasidim were also very virulently anti-Zionist, and his whole life he was an anti-Zionist, until he said what he saw didn't accord with what he was being taught, and he just turned his whole life around. Rav Yosef, I think it's Yosef Teichtal, wrote a sefer called Ema Benim Smicha, which has been translated into English a long time ago. It's an amazing sefer. He wrote it all by memory. He had no svarim. I think he was in the ghetto. He had no svarim, and he quotes svarim in there. I have trouble reading it because I don't recognize many of the names of the svarim that he quotes in there, meaning we don't have them anymore. He's quoting a lot of them from memory. So you see here a transformation. So that's the beginning of the history of Rabbi Soloveitchik. But there's even more to it. What was his relationship with Eretz Yisrael in general? So this is actually before Hakamat HaMedina. In 1935, Rabbi Soloveitchik was one of the major candidates for the chief rabbinate of Tel Aviv. And this actually, 1935, he visited Tel Aviv for the first and only time in his life that he was in Eretz Israel. Born in 1903, died in 1983, was in Eretz Israel in 1935, that was it. Never went back, didn't visit, didn't anything. Now, there are many reasons why we might see, well, we'll see later why he didn't, you know, why he didn't actually just live there, but why he didn't visit might have to do actually with his family. Every time he went, he was in danger of clashing with the family that was there, who were being apprised of his views, and he might have been a little bit afraid of that, and that's why it wasn't fun for him to visit Eretz Yisrael. Maybe one of the reasons. But what's with this chief rabbinate? So his name was on the docket for chief rabbinate of Tel Aviv, and as you can see here, actually, after he visited Rabbi Moshe Soloveitchik, which is his father, it's his father, who was at the time a Rosh Yeshiva in Yeshiva University, wrote to one of the people who was in charge of deciding who was going to be the chief rabbinate of Israel, of Tel Aviv rather, writing an article, basically a recommendation for his son. And he starts off saying, of course, you know, a father is not a valid witness for his son, but he says, I'm not speaking on behalf of myself, I'm telling you what everybody knows. My son was a genius, he was brilliant from the time he was a child, but not only is he brilliant in Torah, he's brilliant in everything. You see the last few paragraphs he says over here. A city like Tel Aviv has many factions. It needs a leader who speaks in popular language and in terms that all can understand. And he says that his son is the only one fit for the position because he can talk to everybody. Why can he talk to everybody? Because what made Rabbi Soloveitchik so unique, many things made him unique, was that again, in another way, he also rebelled against the tradition of his fathers and his grandfathers. He went out and he got a PhD. Rabbi Soloveitchik, basically for the first 20 years of his life, was learning Torah, Torah, Torah. He was homeschooled. I have no idea. He might have learned a little bit of secular stuff on the side, but eventually he went out at the age of 20, around the age of 20, he got out and he got a degree. And then after a little while, he ended up in the University of Berlin with, you know, brilliant minds that were there with him, both in secular and in religious. A few rabbis were there with him. The Lubavitcher Rebbe was there, Rav Yitzchak Kuttner was there, Chaim Leibovitz was there. There were a lot of people there. Not that they were like, I don't think they went out to lunch together all the time, but they knew each other. He was in class at the Lubavitcher Rebbe, but he also studied under these great philosophers, and he got his PhD in philosophy.
In Germany.
In Germany, in Berlin.
What year is he talking about? Before the war?
The 1920s. In the 1920s, I think 1925. No, he got the PhD in 1930 or 1931. It's machlokas. There's like different documents. The 1930 or 1931, he got his PhD. He wrote it on the thought of, I think, Buber, although I might be mistaken with someone else. But he got a PhD in philosophy. So what Moshe Soloveitchik is saying is that who better to be the chief rabbi of Tel Aviv, this diverse city, than the person who is one of the greatest Talmudic minds of our generation, and at the same time has all of this general knowledge. He can talk to anybody. He's perfect. Didn't work out. But what I have over here is an interesting excerpt that I really wanted you to see. This is from Rabbi Lekevitz, the Rav, and this is a quote that Rabbi Soloveitchik is describing a certain thing that happened in his visit to Tel Aviv, when he was visiting with a friend of his, Rabbi Zev Gold. He says, I'll never forget the evening that we were in Ramat Gan in Eretz Yisrael, and he says he took him out to see the orange grove near his house, and it was a beautiful night, and the stars were out, and you could see the lights of Tel Aviv. And Rabbi Gold says, whoever does not feel the presence of God in Eretz Yisrael on this beautiful night while looking at the magnificent moon and at these beckoning stars, breathing the clear and pure air filled with the fragrance of blossoming growth, and above all, when looking at the glistening lights of the city that was built entirely by Jews, is simply blind. That's what Rabbi Gold says to Rabbi Soloveitchik. But what I think, and it's a beautiful statement, and remember this is even before the emergence of the state, but I think what Rabbi Soloveitchik says about this is even more telling. The last paragraph he says, as we stood there, Rabbi Gold picked up a small pebble and kissed it to fulfill Rav Abba's dictum in the Talmud that he would kiss the rocks of Akko. That night I thought to myself how insignificant I was compared to the special Jew who was able to experience the glory of God through the grandeur of the landscape of the land of Israel. Now at the same time that Rabbi Soloveitchik is excited by Rabbi Gold's description of Eretz Yisrael, what do you see on the other hand? Say again?
He goes home to America.
Besides, but
he's
in
not,
this statement,
he's not experiencing
he doesn't feel it. Mm-hmm. And I think we're going to see that come out later. He doesn't feel that. He says he feels small because he doesn't feel that. And we're going to see, I think we're going to see why a little bit later. Okay, fast forward after 1935. As I said, he failed. He did not get the chief rabbinate of Tel Aviv position.
Did he want it?
No, he did want that. He wanted it badly. But in 1944, now this is already after he's the chairman. Sorry, this is when he becomes the chairman of the RZA, of the Religious Zionist Movement of America. So he's already in the Mizrahi movement involved, and he gets in trouble. Right? So they got a habit of getting in trouble because when you're a famous person and you're important, people, come after you to try to get you to say things that will get you in trouble. And so he was being interviewed by... No, that was later.
Who got the position that he wanted?
Who got the position that he wanted?
Was it Rav Cook, right?
No, I'm trying to remember.
Was it
that was later. That was for the chief rabbi. Who got the position? I don't remember the name.
Of Tel Aviv Yafo?
I had it, and then I forgot it. I'm not sure. But, so now he's the head of the Mizrahi, and apparently he was interviewed about the Mizrahi, and about some of their statements, and the Mizrahi in Israel, about some of their statements, about some of their positions and political positions, and he wasn't totally positive toward them. In other words, he criticized some of the positions of the Mizrahi. Oh, there you go. Google says it's Rabbi Amiel. That was right. I remember that now. So he was written to by some of the Mizrahi in Eretz Yisrael, complaining, you came out against us on certain things. About, let's say, for instance, about religious coercion. There were certain issues of where the Mizrahi in Eretz Yisrael wanted to police some of the religious aspects of living in Israel, and This is actually, let me step back for a second. This is written in 1961. He became the chairman in 1944. So he was already for many years, he was the chairman. So this is a letter from 1961, much later, after after the Hakamat HaMedina. And he here, I think, says something really incredible. He basically, you know, he defends himself. I'm allowed to criticize Mizrahi about what some of their policies are. But at the same time, he says, but don't think that I don't believe in the Mizrahi movement. So now one might ask, what does Rabbi Soloveitchik think the Mizrahi movement is? What does he think it's about? Yeah, that's important, right? In order to understand what Rabbi Soloveitchik was for, we need to understand how he viewed the movement. And so to see how he viewed the movement, he writes here explicitly. He says, I'm looking in the first paragraph on this side. In the middle, he says, for me, Mizrahi is not only a political organization to whom we must gratefully acknowledge its contribution to the building of the land of Israel. He says, of course, I'm grateful to Mizrahi for building the land of Israel. But it's also an ideological movement. And he's going to say that it's an ideological movement that has a philosophy that is not exclusive or isolated in Eretz Israel. He thinks that the Mizrahi movement is important for the whole world. And we're going to see this as a theme. In what way is the Mizrahi movement a movement that has to do with the whole world? Says, because the Mizrahi movement is essentially a movement that encourages engagement with the entire world from a Jewish perspective. So we have not removed, I'm looking at the bottom of that column at the end, at the beginning of the paragraph, we have not removed ourselves from such a world, nor have we withdrawn into a secluded corner. We are unwilling to become a religious sect that forfeits the general public for the benefit of individuals. We will not build a Noah's Ark. What's Noah's Ark? He's saying we will not build in Eretz Israel a Noah's Ark. Our prayers are for everyone. It is our desire to purify and sanctify the modern world by means of the eternal vision, constant in its purity and grandeur. How does he see the mission of Mizrahi in Eretz Israel?
As a light unto the nation.
As a light, as something that is going to purify the whole world. Right? As something that's not specific to Eretz Israel at all. As something that's a beacon for the entire world. So we don't fear progress in any area of life. And so he says, I'm not opposed to Mizrahi. Well, if that's his vision of Mizrahi, then he's not opposed to it. I'm not sure, I'm not certain whether or not, I don't know, I'm not certain that the Mizrahi leadership in Eretz Israel would agree with his definition of their mission. Nevertheless, of course, we occasionally have differences of opinion about what should happen in Eretz Israel, but he says basically that that's how he views Mizrahi. Okay? This is, again, this is a foreshadowing, I'm telling you, of what his philosophy, intellectual philosophy, was regarding Eretz Israel. But now fast forward again, 1950, well, it's actually backwards, 2 years before he wrote this letter, in 1959, this is the time when Rabbi Soloveitchik is on the docket once again in Eretz Israel, but this time not for the chief rabbinate of Tel Aviv, but for the chief rabbinate of Eretz Israel entire. Okay, here he's on the line with Rav Unterman and Rav Gorin, who was then the chief rabbi of the IDF. And Rav Unterman at this point was the chief rabbi of Tel Aviv. So this is after the death of Rav Yitzchak or Rav Herzog, and there was a void. They didn't have a chief rabbi for a few years, but Rabbi Soloveitchik was one of the candidates, and the process really dragged on and on and on for political reasons, which is, as we're going to see, part of the reason why Rabbi Soloveitchik never became the chief rabbi of Israel. And basically, the political machinations as they pertained to Rabbi Soloveitchik was, there was a movement in the Knesset, there was an attempt in the Knesset to add an amendment, to add a law, that the chief rabbi of Israel had to be currently an Israeli citizen. That wasn't the law they wanted to make it, and he felt that was clearly directed towards him. That it was being motivated by people who didn't want him to be the chief rabbi. He doesn't become the chief rabbi. He never becomes the chief rabbi. And it's not clear whether he could have been if he wanted to. It's not clear. It sounds like, from the way that he describes things, that he could have been if he had wanted to, that the people that wanted him to be kept on wanting him to be. He dropped out. And here he explains why. He writes a letter to one of his supporters. He says, I do not have the strength to express my thoughts in proper idiomatic language and give decisive rulings regarding issues of weighty substance. However, okay, he says, I'm revealing my heart to you without any attempt to give some political cover to my intentions. Here he's describing why he declined. He eventually dropped out of the race. He says, at first when I was informed in your name that you were ready to stand by my side and give me your support, I decided to listen to you and take up the burden of the rabbinate. I hoped that I would be able to separate the technical political side from the great spiritual work of spreading Torah and knowledge, and that I would be able to devote my time and energy to teaching, thinking and contemplation, as his honor has been able to do in such a wonderful fashion. However, there are events in relation to the chief rabbinate, personal as well as party conflicts, the ones that I told you, have shed new light on the situation. He says that he doesn't think that he could continue to study Torah, to teach Torah, and to teach rabbis if he becomes the chief rabbi of Israel. It's too political. The position is not a position for a rabbi, it's a position for a politician. I want to just give you an impression of what Rabbi Soloveitchik was in America. At the time, I didn't live in this time, but I've read enough about it, and I think I have a clear enough picture. At the time that Rabbi Soloveitchik lives, I think there were four major figures in America. There were four major figures in America, rabbinic figures. There was Rabbi Soloveitchik, there was Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, there was Rav Aaron Kotler, and there was Rabbi Lubavitch Rebbe. As far as I'm concerned, those are the four major figures, and they each took a different role. Rabbi Moshe Feinstein was the undisputed posek. He was the posek. If you had a shaila, you went to Rav Moshe Feinstein. Rav Aaron Kotler was the leader of the Kollel movement. In other words, in terms of just pure learning Torah, he started Lakewood, he created Torah in Eretz Yisrael. He just did. The Lubavitch Rebbe was a Lubavitch Rebbe. Nothing more needs to be said. Rabbi Soloveitchik ordained over 2,000 rabbis in his lifetime. Rabbi Soloveitchik was the rabbi's rabbi. Okay? YU was responsible for I don't know what percentage of the rabbis in America, and many of them can claim that they have smicha from Rabbi Soloveitchik. Now, what it means to have smicha from Rabbi Soloveitchik is a little bit questionable. It means his name was on the Tudat Smicha. I have a lot of names on my Tudat Smicha. Not all of them can I claim would know me. But he was the leader of an entire movement of rabbis. Okay? That's what he was in America. And he wanted to do that in Eretz Yisrael, but he did not feel that he could, because he saw that in America he could be, and he loved to say this, in America he could be a melamed, and in Eretz Yisrael he would have to be a politician, and he was not willing to do that under any circumstances. He said over and over, people asked him, here you have at the bottom, Elie Wiesel, who was a journalist before he wrote those books. He had an interview with Rabbi Soloveitchik. Again, Rabbi Soloveitchik gets in trouble in this interview. And Elie Wiesel asked him, what happened? And he basically says the same thing. I couldn't extricate the political side from the rabbinical side. He says, well, why did you think you could? He said, I don't know, I was delusional. That's what he said. He said, I thought I could. And it took me 2 years to figure out that I couldn't. In this, as I said, in this interview, though, he gets in trouble again. Elie Wiesel asks him, he talks to him about the state of Jewry in America. And Rabbi Soloveitchik says he's very, very proud of Jewry in America. He says the young men there study Shas and Poskim along with their electrical engineering and along with their science and chemistry and literature. They study Shas and Poskim and they learn. And he's very proud of them. And Elie Wiesel asks them, are they going to make Aliyah? And Rabbi Soloveitchik answers, a nice dream, but I doubt if it will ever happen. The youth and Jews in general are no longer drawn towards Israel as they once were. They take interest in it and would do anything on its behalf, but they will not settle there. Why? In the past few years, again, this is in 1959, in the past few years there has been a change in the attitude of the American Jew toward Israel. For example, I recall that when I was a boy, the land of Israel was for me a deep inner experience. Of course, when he was a boy, there was no Medinat Israel, which might have made this easier. I'm just saying. It might have been easier to have a deep transcendental a position towards Eretz Yisrael when you can't go there. Just me.
Well, when he was a boy, he was in this anti-Zionist house.
Yeah, but towards the land, he's saying. Yeah, towards the land. He's saying even towards the land, he thinks that the American Jews don't have that same. He says, when I would hear the name Eretz Yisrael, every bone in my body would tremble. Today, Israel has become a concept which does not draw the depths of the soul or the longings of all generations. Today, the term Israel has lost the messianism in it. Okay, so in other words, what Rabbi Soloveitchik seems to be saying is that when we gained a state, we lost an aretz. And he's saying that's just the way it is, and he's saying, you know what, I don't think it's the worst thing in the world, but he says, in terms of people being drawn towards it, it's harder now, because now it's a nationalistic movement as opposed to a religious movement, and a religious movement is always going to be stronger than a nationalist movement. He gets in big trouble for this, because, as you can imagine. In fact, they make this, if you look, you'll notice that the title, out of all, this is a long interview, he says a lot of things. But the title that Haaretz, in which this article was printed. The title the Haaretz chose was Aliyat Noar Yehudi Me'Arzot Abrit Hibachinat Chalom Yafeh. Out of the entire interview, which I'm telling you, the entire interview was not about this. The koteret, the title was Making Aliyah from Eretz Yisrael from America, to Eretz Yisrael from America is a nice dream. That's what they took. So we got in trouble for this. And our Salvechik, in defending himself, said that Elie Wiesel took his words out of context, and he brings us a proof, the fact that the last sentence says that today the term Israel has lost the messianism in it. And he says, I have never and will never, and I can't condone the idea of associating Israel with messianism. We're going to get back to that. And he's right. He doesn't. And that's a kind of a hint that some editorializing was done over here, and we're going to see. And now we're going to say, okay, that's the end of kind of a short history. Any questions about the history of Rabbi Soloveitchik? We're going to get a little bit back to it at the end when we get to the question of Aliyah and why he never did it, but let's hold off on that. Now I want to get to kind of his theory. Okay, you have this incredible mind who was in the Mizrahi movement. What did he write? What did he say about Israel, about Medinat Yisrael, about Eretz Yisrael, in terms of, in the scope of Jewish history, in terms of its relevance, in terms of mitzvos, in terms of spirituality, what did he think? So we'll start on the positive side. Rabbi Soloveitchik wrote a book, or didn't write a book, he gave a speech called Kol Dodi Dofek. It's been translated into English a long time ago, called Fate and Destiny. It's a must read. It's a must read. And in this book, he basically is describing, not the whole essay, it's about halfway through to the essay that he gets to Eretz Yisrael, but he basically describes the movement through history of the Jew and where Eretz Yisrael fits into it. And there are two major parts to the book vis-a-vis Eretz Yisrael. The first part is the six knockings. Okay, Kol Dodi Dofek in general is a midrash, is a exegesis on Shir HaShirim, on the book of Shir HaShirim. The book of Shir HaShirim describes a relationship between two beloveds, a chatan and a kala, a man and a woman. And the truth is actually that Rabbi Soloveitchik has two books about Shir HaShirim. One is called Ubikashta Misham, which has also been translated into English by And From There You Shall Seek, which emphasizes the general man-God relationship. It says that this man and woman relationship is really a metaphor for the general man-God relationship, not exclusive to Judaism. But in Fate and Destiny, in Kol Dodi Dofek, he looks at the Shir HaShirim relationship as being specifically between the Jewish people and God, and about that relationship. In this section of the book, he focuses on a certain section of Shir HaShirim. There's a famous parak, parak vav of Shir HaShirim, which describes the woman, the beloved, laying in her bed, in her pajamas, and her beloved, the man, comes to the door and is knocking at the door, and telling her to come down, and she is kind of like, doesn't want to get up, she's still dreaming, she hears it a little bit, she hears it, but she doesn't want to get up, she's in her pajamas already, she took off her clothes, gonna have to put my clothes back on. It's so annoying. But then after like a few seconds, she realizes what's going on. Oh my God, that's my beloved. And she jumps out of bed and runs down to the door. And by the time, as you know, she reaches for the door, she opens it up and he's gone. And she goes running after him. Rabbi Soloveitchik says, there are six knocks there. And he says the following. I'll read this part. 8 years ago, in the midst of a night of terror filled with the horrors of Majdanek, Treblinka, and Buchenwald, in a night of gas chambers and crematoria, in a night of absolute divine self-concealment, Hester Panim, in a night ruled by the Satan of doubt and apostasy which sought to sweep the maiden from her house into the Christian church, in a night of continuous searching, of questing for the beloved, that's the Shir HaShirim part, in that very night the beloved appeared. God, who conceals himself in his dazzling hiddenness, suddenly manifested himself and began to knock at the tent of his despondent and disconsolate soul, love, twisting convulsively on her bed, suffering the pains of hell. As a result of the knocks of the door of the maiden wrapped in mourning, the state of Israel was born. Rabbi Soloveitchik sees the state of Israel, Hakamat HaMedina, as the knocks on the door. And he actually says you can count them. There are six knocks. And he says, there are six knocks in the history, six knocks of Medina Yisrael. I don't have them here, I'll tell you them. Number one, he says, the first knock is the political knock. The establishment of the state of Israel was a miracle. He says, never in the United Nations had there been any law or bill or resolution upon which two nations who are at each other's throats agreed upon. What am I referring to?
Russia and America.
Russia and America. They agreed on this one bill, which is unheard of. It made no sense at the time. It was a clear miracle. He says the idea. He says he thinks that it might be that the United Nations came into existence simply to put a stamp on Eretz Israel. That's what he says. And they haven't done anything since. And he says that's why they came into existence. Number two, he says the battlefield. The IDF defeating the Arab countries in 1948, later on in 1967, says that is also one of the knockings. The theological, right? Salvechik, for him this was very real. It has become less real for us because we actually, you know, many people might not even know this. I'm sure you all know this, but Christians believed until 1948 that the Jews were never going back to Eretz Israel. In fact, it was a part of an article of their faith.
Catholic.
That the Jews, the Catholics, that they would never get back to Eretz Israel. It would never be ours again because we rejected. Something happened. We got it. And so the Pope had to basically redefine the Christian religion, mm-hmm. redefine this article of their faith. He says, that's crazy. That's an amazing thing. They had to deal with that. He says, that's the third knock. The fourth knock is the slowing of the process of assimilation. He says, Judaism was on a downward spiral. Even in Europe, you know, no matter what they tell you, even in Europe, it was in a downward spiral. America had nothing, compared to what it has now, it had nothing. And he said, Eretz Israel slows the process of assimilation because it gives people pride, and it also gives us a place to be safe and to be just with each other. Number five, Jewish blood is not hefker. That's what he says. He says, it's not, for the first time in history, that we have our own army. For the first time in history, the first time in 2,000 years, that you can't just kill a Jew on the street and then say, you know, who cares? It's just a Jew. And the sixth knock is that any Jew can find refuge in homeland. This is simply to say that for the first time in 2,000 years that we can come back there to Israel. So that's a knock. I'll just add my own thing. For him, this is, I'll read it inside. He has already been knocking for more than 8 years and still has not received the proper response. He's talking to the Jews in America. Nevertheless, he continues to knock. We have been fortunate. The beloved did not show any particular regard to his own cherished darling, but he continues to favor us. On that fateful night, the maiden's beloved knocked on the door of her tent for only a brief moment and then disappeared. But he treats us with extreme patience. He says, God is being nicer now than he was to the beloved. He's waiting a little bit longer. But he goes on and he says, we've been remiss. American Jewry did not make Aliyah like this should have. He goes on and he says that we should have colonized the Negev immediately. Okay. I want to just add one thing. My own editorializing of the way that he basically midrashifies the Shir HaShirim, basically making it into a modern midrash, that the modern midrash of this story in Shir HaShirim is the story of the Jews who need to get up when they hear the knocking of the door in Eretz Israel. That I thought to myself, so this beloved, she's in her pajamas, she's sleeping in her bed, and the knock comes on the door, but she won't get up, presumably because she is asleep, right? And if she's asleep, she's probably also dreaming. And I wonder to myself, I wonder what she's dreaming about. And then I thought to myself, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if she's dreaming about Eretz Israel. And the dream was so much more alluring than to get up and actually do it. And I'm telling you that coming from the milieu of a quote-unquote religious Zionist modern Orthodox yeshiva high school, obviously, the amount of talk about Zionism and moving to Eretz Israel was very great. I can't blame anybody. But let's just say I have friends who made Aliyah and whose parents said, you know, you're leaving us, how could you leave us? And they looked at their parents and they said, you sent me to a religious Zionist high school. For years they talked to me about Eretz Israel. Why are you surprised that I left? And the parents can't understand it, because for the parents, maybe, could get in trouble for saying this, but the dream of Eretz Israel is much more exciting than the reality of it. And for the maiden to actually get out of bed, put on her clothes, it's much easier to just stay in bed and dream about it.
Checkbook.
He doesn't say that. I'm saying that.
Checkbook Zionism.
What?
Checkbook Zionism.
So the truth is that Rabbi Salvechik, as he's going to go on to say, he's not against checkbook Zionism. He's against, as we're going to see, kind of restricted checkbook Zionism. Explain. He says over here, he goes on, this is after that part of after that part where he basically is encouraging everybody to get involved and to colonize Eretz Israel. He goes on to a major theme of the book, where the English book gets its name from, fate and destiny. What's fate and destiny? So Rabbi Salvechik says that fate and destiny, Jews have both fate and destiny. Fate is what we had in Egypt. Fate is, we have a mutual fate. We are in this together. We're all tied up one with the other. All Jews, what happens to one Jew happens to the other Jew. We're brothers and sisters and family, right? That's fate. And we can't break out of that. That's just who we are. And the world can affect us, and we're going to always be affected by the world, and it's kind of a suffering that way. We have a mutual suffering fate. But he says there's also destiny. And destiny is when we take control of our lives. Destiny is when we actually try to push forward the plan of history, the plan of God. And he said, until Hakamat Medina, we were focused on fate, on living together and, you know, mutually suffering with one another. And cohesing, and being cohesive that way. But he said, with the Knox, we need to take hold of destiny. We need to take hold and look forward and try to take more. And try to push forward the plan of history. And he says that what he sees is that the two camps, the two poles that take positions on Zionism, each one of them emphasizes a different aspect. He's going to say secular Zionism is going to emphasize which one?
Destiny.
And anti-religious, anti-Zionism is going to reflect the fate, right?
Yeah.
So he says, however, the error of secular Zionism is more serious than simply not understanding the true meaning of the covenant in Egypt. Saying, secular Zionism, they don't understand fate. They don't understand the covenant in Egypt. The covenant of a camp people, that's another thing that he differentiates between the machaneh and the kihilah, between the camp and the congregation, which is parallel. He says, the covenant of a camp people which takes the form of shared fate and involuntary isolation. Secular Zionism has sinned as well against the covenant at Sinai, the covenant made with the holy congregation nation. They're against fate. They're against being burdened by tradition, by our Knesset Yisraelness, the fact that we're connected to other Jews, the fact that we're connected to the Torah. That's part of the fate aspect of Judaism. And they're against that. Only the religious Shivat Zion movement with its traditional authentic approach has the capacity to rectify these distortions. And here he says something key, okay? This is what you need to watch. If you were to ask me, what is the task of the state of Israel? All right, this is where you're going to see him define it. What is the task of the state of Israel? I would answer, the mission of the state of Israel is neither the termination of the unique isolation of the Jewish people, nor the abrogation of its unique fate. What are those two things? Those are fate and destiny. It's not the termination. It's not the getting rid of the uniqueness of the Jewish people. In this it will not succeed. But it's the elevation of a camp people to break the rank of a holy congregation nation and the transformation of shared fate to shared destiny. It's to take the shared fate. It's to take the fate aspect that the anti-Zionists have put a trademark on, and to take that and inject a little bit of destiny in it. Inject a little bit of pushing forward. Elevating it. And here he takes a pot shot, though, at the other side. He says, at the top of the next page, our sense of unity with Knesset Yisrael, according to the authentic view of Judaism, must remain incomplete as long as it derives from the covenant of fate made with the camp people living in existence of compulsion. As long as we're only living in existence of compulsion, that we're always acted upon, says we're never going to be complete. A covenant to which we are bound by external constraints. It can only be complete if it derives from the covenant made with the congregation, from the covenant of shared destiny. We need to also come together in order to create something new. That's his pot shot at the anti-Zionists. An existence of fate cannot satisfy man. We can't just constantly sit back and let things happen to us until outside force changes it. On the contrary, it inflicts pain upon them. The sense of isolation is destructive. It can crush us. Okay, just go to the last paragraph over there. He says, let us review yet once again what was stated earlier. How do fate and destiny differ? In two ways. First, fate entails an existence of necessity, right? That things are going to happen to us. Destiny is freely willed. It's created by man, and he chooses and charts his own path in life. Okay? So Rabbi Soloveitchik basically says you need to have this synthesis. You can't take the secular Zionist approach of the new Jew, that we're just going to create something and forget about everything that came from beforehand. And we're going to say, let's forget about all the Jews in the Gullus, because those are Gullus Jews. We're not interested in them. If they want to make Aliyah and become like us, then great. That's wonderful. Become the new Jew. That's to ignore fate. That's to ignore the burden of the covenant of Sinai. But, on the other hand, he says, to say constantly that we're just going to stay in Gullus until somebody comes along and takes us out, and we're not going to try to pull ourselves out of this, build something for ourselves based on our tradition, says that's also wrong. That's also wrong. So that's kind of the positive, the positivist look at Rabbi Soloveitchik Zionism. But that's not so simple, okay? Let's look at the flip side. And the flip side, the truth is, you can find it here and there in his actual writings. But the first place where I saw it so startlingly portrayed was in this book, The Rav Thinking Aloud, Rabbi David Holzer. This came out about 5 years ago. And basically, this is such a funny book. Basically, it's a series of conversations that were taped by Rabbi Holzer, who walked around with Rabbi Soloveitchik. He taped his conversations with him. And at a certain point, I guess he transcribed them all. And he wrote it up, and he wrote this book. It did not go over well with the family that he was going to put out this book, because this is not things that Rabbi Soloveitchik wrote that he wanted to be published. It could be that Rabbi Soloveitchik wouldn't have wanted any of this published. So the family was very against it. In fact, I worked for a publication that somebody wrote in a review of this book, and the editor of the publication said, we're not going to review the book because he thinks it's Lashon Hara. Because how could you? He didn't want this out. Now, I don't know, because one of the claims is, oh, you taped him secretly. You can pass this around, but maybe you guys remember this. This is a picture that he says of the classroom, and Rabbi Holzer is in the picture. And they're all talking to Rabbi Soloveitchik, and as he points out, this is the tape recorder on the desk. You can pass it around if you want, but the tape recorder, if this picture is accurate, is about this big.
Yeah,
that was the size of the pen.
And he was walking around with this. Okay? It wasn't in his jacket. So there was no doubt that Rabbi Soloveitchik knew that he was being taped. Whether he wanted it printed afterwards, I don't know. But the most fascinating part of this book is the conversation. It's basically a shiur that Rabbi Soloveitchik gives. And the shiur was given on Yom Ha'atzma'ut 1978. This is Yom Ha'atzma'ut 1978. The yeshiva that morning had davened a special davening, as they still do to this day, with Hallel and with Haftorah reading. Okay? This is a version of the Tfilah that the Rabbanut came out with, and the Yeshiva University, why you did this. In the middle of... the Rav did not say Hallel. They said Hallel in the middle of davening with a bracha. The Rav did not say Hallel, and when they started taking out the Sefer Nevi'im for the Haftorah, along with the Sifri Torah for the Kriyasa Torah, he walked out. In the yeshiva, in Shir that day, he basically came in and he said, I want to talk about what happened this morning. They didn't have to ask him. He said, I want to talk about what happened this morning. And it's pages and pages, it's probably an hour and a half Shir, of him basically answering questions about Zionism, about Judaism, and about the state of Israel. A lot of them are halachic. The question of whether or not to say Hallel is not, according to Rabbi Soloveitchik, is not a Zionist question. That's a halachic question. You can say Hallel after davening. That's what he thought you should do. You should say Hallel after davening. You shouldn't be part of the davening. The question of saying the Haftorah, he thought was ridiculous. He thought it was a joke. Just to read the Haftorah. If you want to read the Nevi'im afterwards, he thought, fine. But to read it as a Haftorah in the middle of davening, he thought it was a joke. He thought we had no power to enact these things. So leave that aside. In other words, Rabbi Soloveitchik was a strict halachic Jew. It wouldn't have mattered if he was the most ardent religious Zionist. He wouldn't have condoned this. But then it goes further, and the students start to ask him questions about Zionism. Is it at all proper to put aside a day of Hoda'ah? Is it all proper to have a Yom Ha'atzmaut at all? There was a Yeshua, no doubt about it. A great Yeshua. After the Second World War, we were in a very bad position. Missionaries, assimilationists of all kinds, came out of the hiding places telling us this was exactly the result of the Jewish standards to retain their Jewish identity. And if not for Medina Israel, we would have been destroyed. Now, what kind of position is this to take? In other words, if that's his answer, what kind of position is this to take? How does he feel about Yom HaTzmaut? Yes. It's positive. It's a day of Hoda'ah, but a Hoda'ah of what? Thank God we were saved.
Salvation.
Salvation. Thank God we were saved, because we would have been dead if not for the state of Israel. Is this the way that most religious Zionists feel on Yom HaTzmaut? What are most? I think there are other emotions to describe, aside from Hoda'ah, to describe the emotions that a religious Zionist feels on Yom HaTzmaut nowadays. What other emotions might they feel?
In the
commitment.
Pride. God intervening.
Hope. God intervening. A feeling of God intervening even now. Right? Yeah. Those are the feelings that I think that we would describe. Not this. But it goes further. What should be done? Is the whole idea of Yom HaTzmaut a proper idea? That's what the student asks. He says, I don't know. It's no idea. For my part, Yom HaTzmaut can be Yom Yerushalayim. I don't care about the date. In my opinion, there's no Kedushas Hayom in the day. But the fact, the event of Medina Yisrael requires Shevach V'Hodah to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and not only Yom HaTzmaut, on 365 days of the year. Again, totally positive. He says we need to be thankful. We need to be positive towards Eretz Yisrael. But here is where things start to go off the rails. Is there any validity to the Hakamas of Medina as far as Geula or Yeshivas Tzion is concerned? Before you turn the page, what are you hoping for here?
Yes.
You're hoping for a yes. Well, sorry. No. No. Yemei HaMashiach? No. And you can hear the ridicule in his voice, at least on the transcription. No. Since it contributed greatly to the survival of our people, it's very important. This itself is important. But all this stupidity, Aschalta de Geula, Geula, I'm against it. For the Rav, the idea that Hakamat HaMedina somehow fit into the, for him, halachic concept of Geula, the codified way of looking at what's going to happen B'Yom HaMashiach, he was totally against it. He says, I don't know what's going to happen, but I know that it's not required that we have a state of Israel in order for Geula to happen. It's not as though the original plan, as it was given from God, had to be that we needed to make a state of Israel, and only then could we have Geula. He says, that's not the way it is. Now, of course, as we've seen him say already, the state of Israel can play a role in Geula, but how can it play a role? What role will the state of Israel play? And here I want to, basically, this is the Kav, one of the Kavim, where he separates from Rabbi Cook and other religious Zionists completely. According to Rabbi Cook, what role does...
If it brings people closer to...
Exactly. According to Rabbi Cook, let's say, according to Rabbi Cook, what role does Eretz Yisrael play in terms of the process of redemption?
Central
role. It is the process of redemption. This is the beginning. This will lead to redemption. Eretz Yisrael, right now, we are in a state of redemption. We're not at the end of the redemption. There's more to come. But right now, 1948 was the Kav, was the date of redemption. When we look back at it, 1948 is the day of the redemption. From a Salvechik, no, it's not. 1948 is a day like any other day. Great day. A wonderful day. It was the day that the Jews got something to be proud of. It was the day that the assimilation started to, the tide turned on the assimilation, because we got something to be proud of, because we were able to open up more yeshivas, because the world was a little bit more afraid of us. Great day. But part of the Geula, he goes so far as to say, and I didn't put it on here because I didn't want to, students asked him, you know, what happens if something, you know, is it possible that something, you know, could happen to the state of Israel? And he says, of course it's possible. He says, anything is possible. After Hitler, he says, a man is capable of anything. A man is capable of being a demon. Anything is possible. There's no way of knowing that the state of Israel is going to be around forever. Would a cook in a million years ever say that? Not in a million years. I don't think most people who are, you know, normal religious Zionists would ever say that. Baruch Soloveitchik didn't view this state as being an integral, you know, necessary part of the redemption. But there's more. In terms of Eretz Yisrael itself, how did he view Eretz Yisrael beyond the Medina? Fine, we get the impression Medina for him is a political entity. If I were to go back and rewrite the title, I would say Rabbi Soloveitchik, religious, political Zionist. He was into the politics of Zionism. He was into the state of Israel existing as a political movement, as a political entity, but not as it being a kind of a religious, the focus being religious. like Rav Kook, let's say. But what about Eretz Yisrael itself? So here, this is published, and this is also a starting statement. The Rav addresses the view of the Ramban and Rav Yehuda Levi and many others, that Eretz Yisrael is fundamentally different than any other land in the world. Eretz Yisrael has a special Kiddushah, there's a Shekhinah here, and it's totally different. You can feel it, the mitzvahs are different here than they are everywhere else. I'm not referring to mitzvahs HaTluyos B'Eretz, the mitzvahs that are contingent upon the land, but all mitzvahs, wearing tefillin in Eretz Yisrael is different than wearing tefillin in America or in Johannesburg or in London or in Manchester. It doesn't matter. It's different here because God is more manifest here. Rabbi Soloveitchik says the following. Kedusha, under halachic aspect, is man-made. More accurately, it is a historical category. A soil is sanctified by historical deeds performed by a sacred people, never by any primordial superiority. In other words, there's no such thing as anything, an object, having inherent holiness by itself. The halachic term Kedusha Ta'aretz, the sanctity of the land, which we see as meaning what? We see Kedusha Ta'aretz as being like this halo. You know, this glow coming out of the ground, right? That's how we see it. The sanctity of the land denotes the consequence of a human act, either conquest or the mere presence of the people in that land. Kedusha is identical with man's association with Mother Earth. Nothing should be attributed a priori to dead matter. Objective Kedusha smacks of fetishism. For him, the idea that Eretz Yisrael is holy in a way that is, you know, is halo-like, is glowing, for him, that was, I wouldn't say it's a vodazara, but for him, it was anathema to halachic Judaism. It says, in halacha, kedusha is what we do to objects. When we write Sifrei Torah, when we write tefillin, when we write mezuzos, right? When we shake a lulav and etrog, we create kedusha. When we till the land in Eretz Yisrael and give trumas and maestros, when we are careful not to do kilayim, when we obey the laws of orla, when we go up to the Beit HaMikdash, we create that kedusha. In a nutshell, basically, according to Rabbi Soloveitchik, you know, if a tree falls in the woods, right? If Eretz Yisrael is sitting there and there's no Jew sitting and there's no Jew on the land, there's no Kedusha. It's just not there. So for him, that's what Rav Chaim's dream was, to come to Israel and do these mitzvos that he couldn't do elsewhere. But because there was going to be Kedusha, new Kedusha, when he got there. But it had no Kedusha on itself. And I want to hark you back to what Rabbi Gold said, that he looked at Tel Aviv and the lights and the land, and he kissed the pebbles. And by the way, their Gemara is about kissing, because as they said, their Gemara is about that, which is, you know, poses its own problem for Rabbi Soloveitchik. But he's just being honest. Rabbi Soloveitchik didn't feel that because he doesn't believe it. He doesn't believe that the pebbles have kedusha just because it's in this geographical location. He believes that it has mitzvos. He believes that there's more potential in this land. And he believes, I don't think I put it on, maybe I put it on, he believes that we have a connection to the land, but you'll wait till you see how he defines that connection. But he doesn't believe that the land itself is fundamentally different. If we are not in the equation, there's no specific specialness to the land of Israel for Rabbi Soloveitchik. Did you want to ask a question?
Well, I wanted to say, I find this, does he not relate to Hashem's promise to give us this land? Why this
perfect
land?
Segue.
Why not Engadin?
Perfect segue. Back to that lecture that he was giving to his students. Here he says even more. And you're going to make a lot of people upset, so it's good that we're almost done. his students ask him, so what's the significance of Eretz Yisrael? What's our connection to Israel? What connection do we have, if all you're saying is correct? When there was a kris of bris, when there was a covenant reached with Avraham Avinu and HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Eretz Yisrael was part of the bris. In other words, the covenant, the deal made between God and Avraham, and Yitzchak and Yaakov, was a covenant based on the land. V'natati l'chal zaracha acharecha et eretz megurecha, I'm giving you the land for you and for the people afterward. Et kol eretz k'nan l'achuzat olam v'hiti lahem l'elkin. And it's going to be yours, you're going to own it forever. The covenant participated between Avraham HaKadosh Baruch Hu and Eretz Yisrael. That is why the Ramban says that the very moment when one of the Avos would leave Eretz Yisrael or come back into Eretz Yisrael, he would either stop or start doing mitzvahs. Fine. Skip to the next paragraph. This is correct as far as the bris between HaKadosh Baruch Hu and Avraham is concerned. Then, the Eretz played a most important role for Avraham, right? When the Torah was given at Sinai, so HaKadosh Baruch Hu said, V'ata im shamoa tishmu, there's a pasuk in Shmos. V'ata im shamoa tishmu b'koli u'shmartem et b'riti v'hitam li skula mikol ha'amim ki li kol ha'aretz. If you listen to me, and you will be for me You will become for me a unique nation, Kili Kol Haaretz, because the land is mine. What does the land is mine, A, what does it mean? What does the Haaretz there mean? And B, what is its significance? So Rabbi Soloveitchik says, what's Kili Kol Haaretz? Rashi over there says it does not belong. It doesn't belong there. It means that HaKadosh Baruch Hu said to Moshe, this covenant is not limited to space and to land. This covenant is obligatory and binding on every Jew, no matter where he finds himself. No matter whether in Boston or New York or Eretz Israel, whether on Harabayis or on the moon. They had reached the moon by then. Because Kili Kol Haaretz, Kiyom HaMitzvos, is applicable not only to the land, to B'nai Israel, but to any Jew, no matter where he finds himself. Hence, to say Yadus revolves around Yeshuv Eretz Israel would be wrong. However, there is a mitzvah of Eretz Israel, of living in Eretz Israel. For Rabbi Soloveitchik, this pasuk, and he says it a few times in the speech, this pasuk, those four words, Kili Kol Haaretz, nullifies religious Zionism. Because for Rabbi Soloveitchik, there's no difference if you're putting on tefillin in Yerushalayim or you're putting on tefillin in Brooklyn. There's no difference. It doesn't matter. In terms of qua the mitzvah of tefillin itself. Of course, there's an added mitzvah of you doing in Eretz Yisrael because you're living in Eretz Yisrael. That's a separate mitzvah. But it doesn't affect your mitzvahs, and it doesn't have this kind of holistic spirituality to it. There is no holistic spirituality to Eretz Yisrael. It doesn't have a halo. It doesn't have any of that. It's a mitzvah like any other. And our special relationship that Avram and Yitzchak and Yaakov might have had was replaced by our relationship to the Torah that God gave us at Sinai. And he continues. He says, all I object is, you can preach the ideals of Yeshiva Eretz Yisrael, but one thing you should leave out. Not to try to create a doubt in the minds of those who study Torah and are B'nai Yeshiva, that their Yadus is inferior to the Kedushas Yisrael of Eretz Yisraelim who don't study Torah and don't think. He was against people saying that, oh, a secular Jew living in Tel Aviv is superior to a Yeshiva Bachar sitting in Manchester. He says, that's ridiculous. It's ridiculous. He says he's doing one mitzvah. He's doing all the mitzvahs. He says it's ridiculous. He says there's no special kedusha to this Jew who's living in Eretz Yisrael.
Would he at least have considered them equal, perhaps?
No, not at all. Not even close. Not even close. It's not even close. Says, if you study the parashas of Avram properly, you'll find out that there are these two bris, as he explains, that there's a bris that has to do with Eretz Yisrael, but that's not our bris anymore. So then the question becomes, so what's our claim? In other words, why do we come to Eretz Yisrael? It's just a mitzvah? He says, no, there is a little bit more than that. He says, in the last paragraph there, the Avtacha matters so that Eretz Yisrael belongs to us. Adine Mamros. In other words, what is our relationship with Eretz Yisrael currently? Aside from it being a mitzvah, what's our relationship? We have a contract. It's ours. It belongs to us. We bought it. God gave it to us. We didn't buy it. We did buy it. Avram bought it. We own it. That's our relationship with Eretz Yisrael. It's ours. It belongs to us. Our name is on the door. That's our relationship with it. And he says, and also that Eretz Yisrael will be the center of the Shekhinah at the time when the Kadosh Baruch Hu will redeem Knesset Yisrael. Saying, eventually, we will have a special relationship with God in Israel because that's what Mashiach is going to bring about. But he didn't bring it about yet, ultimately. That's Kibbutz Galios. In other words, when there is Mashiach, then there will be Kibbutz Galios, and then all the Jews have to come back to Eretz Yisrael. But right now, that's not necessary. When Rabbi Soloveitchik is encouraging everybody to please come to Eretz Yisrael, why is he encouraging them to come to Eretz Yisrael? To bring about the redemption? No. Because Eretz Yisrael has a lot of good to offer. No, not even the mitzvah. Because for him, he says this a few times, you can do more mitzvot in Chutz La'aretz than doing it in Eretz Yisrael, you should be in Chutz La'aretz.
But you can't possibly, because there are all those mitzvot that apply simply only in Eretz Yisrael, so you can't...
I'm not going to get into it, but there are many reasons to think that there are... Aside from, let's say, besides from mitzvot, if you can play a role that's more beneficial to the Jewish people in Chutz La'aretz than you could in Eretz Yisrael, so then your place is in Chutz La'aretz for Rabbi Soloveitchik. He says it explicitly.
He did such a disservice because he has so much influence. If he would have said the right things to encourage Aliyah,
he was saying the right things.
Now, if he would have said, get your over here.
Well, he did. He did. He pulled back a little bit. I agree with you that he pulled back a little bit. He pulled back a little bit, but I don't think you can say that he didn't do his utmost. I don't think you can say that. to
Are you saying?
No,
he refused.
I'll tell you what I think. He refused to tell people that they needed to go to Eretz Israel because it was a part of the Geula
and a step in the process.
Because he didn't believe it, he couldn't have said that. He told people, "We need more Jews in Eretz Israel because if we don't have more Jews in Eretz Israel, you know what's going to happen? We're going to lose it. And you know what's going to happen if we lose it? Not that Mashiach's not going to come. Mashiach's going to come when he comes. But what's going to happen if we lose it? We're going to be downtrodden again. People are going to mess with us. Jewish blood will be hefker once again. We'll be depressed. We'll lose a lot more Torah. It's going to be terrible." He says, "We need Eretz Israel because it's awesome. That's why we need Eretz Israel. Because it's good for the Jews."
So it's kind of more practical than spiritual.
Leading by going. So you know what? Let's end with that. So with that, we're over time, but I think we have a few minutes before Maariv starts. What happened? What happened to him? So Aliyah. So first, what did he think about other people? So this is another Keta from that lecture. Would Rebbe say that everybody has to make Aliyah? So here you go. He's being asked point blank. Should we make, by his students sitting in the room, should we make Aliyah? He answers, whether the mitzvah of Yeshiva Eretz Yisrael is a priority now, whether or not that's a priority, there are many considerations by which a man should be guided. I have another approach to that. Of course a man should live in Eretz Yisrael. It's a mitzvah. Of course. According to the Ramban, at least. However, a man should also live in a place where he can accomplish the most for Yadus. In other words, asking the Rabbi Soloveitchik if you should live in Eretz Yisrael is like asking him if you should sit in a sukkah. On sukkahs. Of course you should live in Eretz Yisrael. Unless there's a good reason not to. Unless, just like there could be a potential reason why you shouldn't sit in a sukkah on sukkahs, whatever, fine. But yes, you're right, raining, that's a good example. You know, it's hard for you for some reason. Or, you know, you could do more doing something else. Ha'osik b'mitzvah patur min ha'mitzvah. It's a mitzvah like any other, it's not any more important than anything else. But what about himself? So for himself, we'll skip past this actually, because we don't have time. I want you to take a look at this though. Here he got nailed. In 1967...
Where are you?
I don't know what number page it is, but it's the second to last page. Or, you know, second to last side. It's a keta from Community and Covenant and Commitment. Community, Covenant, and Commitment is a collection of letters by Rabbi Soloveitchik that they put together in a thick book. It's a nice thick book, all in English, letters that he had written. And over here he's responding to a woman. There's a woman living in Eretz Israel in a place called Givat, Washington. I don't know where it is. Who had been teaching her students about religious Zionism. And what book had she just finished with her students? Well, not Fate and Destiny. Called Odi Dofet. Because it was in Eretz Israel. I assume. I don't know. Maybe. She was reading to them called Odi Dofet. And what did the students ask at the end of the book?
Where's the Rav?
So where is he? And she asks very timidly, she says, "Kvod HaRav, my students are asking," and it started me wondering as well, "Where are you? Why haven't you come?" So he writes this. He says, "I apologize for not responding." He says, "Thank you for your words, and I accept your rebuke willingly. Indeed, I sinned against the Holy Land. I am amongst those who have fallen back. Of course, many factors that were out of my control prevented me. In spite of this, I'm not searching for an excuse, nor am I justifying myself. I'm guilty, and the blame rests on my shoulders. Last year, we, my wife Zal and I, decided to come to Israel and remain for about 6 months to see the land and the people who dwell therein. This is a trip that never happened. However, many are the plans in man's heart. What happened, happened, and my sighs are many and heart is sick." What he's referring to is that his wife died. "Many of my friends and acquaintances who live whether in the land of Israel or the diaspora are urging me to come now. You also emphasized in your letter that it is now a time of grace and also a time of spiritual crisis." This is right after 1967, where they tried to get a lot of rabbis to come to Israel because there was this movement, there was this Bar Tshuva movement that they needed to support with rabbis. However, our sages told us that sometimes you can't. I thought this was very telling. You know, in the second column over there, he says, "How can I now go up to Jerusalem when I am despondent and embittered? The inspiration does not rest in a state of depression, sadness, and pain." He says, "You don't have to justify your words. I too, a simple Jew, would say in the words of the rabbis of Yavne, I teach, and many others who work in the field of Torah education teach. My work is in the large city of New York, in an institution with great numbers of students, and their work is in Givat, Washington, or some other moshav, in a similarly small institution. One may do much, or one may do little. It is all one, provided he directs his heart to heaven. All our work is dedicated to the flourishing of the values of Judaism, the tradition of our forefathers and our sages. In a nutshell, the Rabbi Soloveitchik says two things. He says, I can't come right now because I'm just depressed. It's not a good time for me right now. But he says, larger than that, I'm not going to come. I'm a Melamed, and my students are here in New York. Boy, were they ever. Right? They ordained over 2,000 people. Over 2,000 students. All right? His son-in-law, Rav Lichtenstein, did move to Eretz Yisrael. That's a piece over here at the bottom. Is a position towards secular Zionism. We're not going to read it inside. But I'll just say, in a nutshell, his position towards secular Zionism was already revealed at the beginning. Whereas many anti-religious Zionists, and you can see this right now, one of the main claims against Eretz Yisrael by the population that is kind of against the state is that it's run by secular people. And you can't, there's no, and this is their same claim against Atchalta of the Geula, that this is a process of redemption. It can't be part of the process of redemption. Very simply cannot be. Why? Because it was started by non-religious Jews. There's no way that something like Geula can come from non-religious Jews. So it looks like he said, the Rav used to quote all the time, the Navi saying that Yeravam ben Yoash, that he was a terrible king. He was terrible, Yeravam. Terrible. But yet, on the other hand, he restored the border of Israel from Mavo Chamat to the Sea of Arava, as the Lord God of Israel had spoken by the hand of the servant Yonas ben Amittai, the prophet from... In other words, the Navi has positive things to say about Yeravam and how he restored the border of Eretz Yisrael. In other words, it's happened before. Great Rishaim have improved the fate of Bnei Yisrael in Eretz Yisrael. He says, if it's happened before, how can it happen again? Whereas Rav Kook would have taken this and just turned it around and said, no, what you see happening is the flowering, is the externalization of the nitzotz, of the spark of Kedusha and the secular Jew, and that, and what he is doing is actually the most holy thing ever. You never heard any of these words from Rabbi Soloveitchik. He would have just said, it's happened before that something great has come from some lowly people. And it's happening right now. So, end of conversation. You don't have to see any further than that. I want to just leave you with the last thing, because we're going to have to have Marv. The last thing, the last keta, which I think kind of totally nutshells this entire lecture. And Rabbi Soloveitchik really captures it in this one paragraph from Community Covenant Commitment. Like I said, it's a book of his letters. It says, I agree with you that there is a third halachic approach which is neither parallel to the position of those whose eyes are shut and reject the significance of the state, that's the anti-Zionists, nor the belief of those dreamers who adopt a completely positive stance to the point where they identify the state with the fulfillment of the highest goal of our historical and meta-historical destiny. That's Rav Kook. Right? This third approach, that's him, which is the normative one in all areas, basically saying the third approach is always the best, the one in the middle, I would allow myself to guess, would be positively inclined towards the state, and would express gratitude for its establishment out of a sense of love and devotion, but would not attach to it excessive value to the point of its glorification and deification. Okay, so you have here Rabbi Soloveitchik, who came from a family of anti-Zionists, political anti-Zionists. They were against the political movement of Zionism. Of course, they weren't against the state, the country of Israel, living there. They longed to live there so that they could fulfill its mitzvos. And he believed that when he was young. But after seeing the Holocaust and after seeing the potential inherent in the land of Israel and all of the fallout, he could no longer deny the hand of divine providence in the state of Israel, and transformed himself, became the president of the RZA, of the Religious Zionist Organization in America, almost became the chief rabbi of Israel, but remained at the same time a great proponent of the state of Israel, but at the same time also a great critic of the state of Israel. He wasn't happy with everything that was happening. He wasn't totally negative. He didn't often come out like that, but he was willing to be negative and to say they were doing things that were wrong or this or that. And at the same time, his religious philosophical views, basically, I would say, he saw the state of Israel as absolutely the hand of God. Absolutely divine intervention, divine providence, absolutely without a doubt about it. Many positive things coming out of it. He saw it as a mitzvah. He thought that if you have the opportunity and no good reason not to, you should absolutely make aliyah. He saw no problems that, let's say, Satmar have problems with people moving en masse to Eretz Yisrael. No problems with that. At the same time, he didn't believe that people should put excessive emphasis on Eretz Yisrael, on living in Eretz Yisrael. It wasn't the central concept of Judaism, according to him. It was not worth more than almost any other mitzvah. Maybe it was high on the priorities, but it wasn't worth more than all the other mitzvahs combined, that's for sure.
That if the mitzvahs are connected with the land, then it must be very special land.
So,
I mean, physically.
It's special when you're there.
Yeah.
It's special when you're there, and he would agree. He's excited about doing those mitzvahs, but you're not there. You don't have those mitzvahs.
It's holiness and its specialness.
He does deny it. He denies its holiness. He denies its inherent holiness. He says it's a special place where you get to do more mitzvahs. That's what he says. Okay. But he takes that, and he says also you can't be never critical of the state of Israel as though it's, because that would be a deification of the land, a deification of the state, and that was completely anathema to him. But again, like I said, he took this middle path, as he did in all things, and he saw great good in Eretz Yisrael. I think he saw great good in Eretz Yisrael, and you could put a period at the end of that sentence, but he didn't see it as being the flowering of the Gula. He didn't see it as being the ultimate value of Judaism. Yeshkov.
Thank you very much.